compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back. Thank you again for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. I know how quickly our time goes by, and so many of you have sent me emails, so I'm going to be getting to more of your emails in this third hour. So we'll probably not do any phone calls today, but there's so much to talk about, and I want to get into more of your emails. So first, a few other things that I thought you might find interesting. This is an interesting story here in the Wall Street Journal. Probably it pertains to you if you were working during the height of COVID and you weren't able to go to work because of the restrictions, and you, like most people, were dealing with your coworkers on Zoom. We did that for a stretch of time here at Relevant Radio. And so we got to see each other on a regular basis, not in person. We got to see each other on Zoom. And there's an interesting psychological way of looking at this that they take up in this article about how meeting coworkers in person for the first time can be disconcerting for people who have only seen them on Zoom. The same is true, by the way, when it comes to radio. I have people who listen to the program, and then when they meet me in person, they say, oh, you're not what I expected. You're not what I thought you would be. I had one person say, I thought you were 6'2" and blonde. And I said, no, pretty much the opposite. Not blonde, that's for sure. Not 6'2". I recall when I was first listening to talk radio, Rush Limbaugh came on the air in 1988. I think it was the summer of 88. And he had gone national. And I first started listening to his program. And it was, you know, like everybody else thought, it was provocative, entertaining. And so it was a widely listened to program. And back in those days, of course, there was no internet. You couldn't just look somebody up and find out what he or she looks like. So for me, I don't know how much time went by, maybe a couple of years. I had no idea what Rush Limbaugh looked like, but I had a mental image of him. And in my mental image, I don't even remember now what that was, but a friend or a coworker or somebody showed me in a magazine a picture of Rush Limbaugh, the first time I'd ever seen him. And I had that odd experience of thinking, wow, he doesn't look anything like what I pictured. And that's just the way it is, because the theater of the mind, especially when you're dealing with somebody's voice and you don't see even their face, you know, it's even different from television. But it can be the same when it comes to Zoom, as this article discusses. So, for example, Melissa Nisbet, she had a problem in mid-May. She wasn't sure what her boss looked like. To make matters worse, he might have been sitting just a few feet away from her. Ms. Nisbet said she had made cookies and dressed in a blazer and slacks to finally meet colleagues in person at a recently launched tech school where they worked. She arrived at their downtown Vancouver, Canada office and sat across from a man in the reception area. Hired just weeks earlier, Ms. Nisbet had been working from home. She said she clutched her baked goods while growing more confident that the school president, with whom she had only chatted via an audio conference call, was now scrolling through his phone in front of her. She guessed it might be him, since they had arrived at the same place at the same time and the meeting that day was only for a small group. She made the first move and introduced herself. I'm your employee, Ms. Nisbet said. Would you like a cookie? Numerous office workers hired during the era of Zoom calls and Slack messages finally saw one another last summer, and even for that matter, some of them this summer, as some firms eased restrictions or squeezed in meetups before the Delta variant started spreading. Many reunions have been sweet, others nerve-wracking, nearly all of them visceral reminders that colleagues are in fact three-dimensional. Emily Brungard joined a software startup in January as employee number two. The company's now seven-person team met in June in Indianapolis, where she lives, and the firm's venture capitalist backers are based. Upon meeting colleagues in a conference room at the investor's office, Ms. Brungard, who is 5'6", said she was shocked to see that she is on the shorter side of the team. The chief executive of the company is about 6'3", and another person on staff is about 5'8". She says, that put me in my place. The marketing manager has no idea why she subconsciously assigned heights to the people that she knew as floating faces on the video hangouts. I guess everyone falls into the average height range in my head until they're proven not average. Some recently hired office workers have gone to great lengths to confirm their virtual colleagues are real. Matt Barash, who lives in Manhattan, he took two flights last month to visit about 30 colleagues at ZioTap, a Berlin-based ad tech firm that he joined in November. The company met during a window in which COVID-19 infections were relatively low and some international travel restrictions had eased. Mr. Barash said, still, colleagues from France and Spain didn't join because of upticks in the cases in their country. So he met up with these people that he had only talked to on Zoom. And he said that the initial moments of their first meeting struck him as profound after months of peering into his colleagues' homes during the workday. So you know how it is. You see somebody at home in the living room or in an office, and you're seeing things in their home because that's where they're broadcasting from. He says there's this weird moment when you lay eyes on someone who you know, but you don't know. A few surreal days went by. Mr. Barash traded phone meetings for walk-in and talks. He met a colleague's dog that he had repeatedly run across the background of video calls. You start to see who's chugging espresso and who's drinking kombucha, says Mr. Barash. We don't chug kombucha here on the Patrick Madrid Show. I'm not even sure what that is. And I can assure you I've never chugged it. So on and on it goes. So all these people, it's just interesting examples of people from around the world who, after meeting people for the first time, having had meetings with them for the better part of a year, if not longer, and then being struck by, you know, they look different. They're different. They're taller. They're shorter. They're wider. They're skinnier. They're not necessarily the people as I imagined them. And even if you see them in these videos on Zoom, for example, it's not the same as seeing somebody in person. So that is a phenomenon that I thought was interesting to discuss in light of the life to come. And as you know, when Jesus returns, he talks about that in Matthew chapter 25, he's going to judge the nations. You know how he talks about, I'm going to come as the judge with my angels, I'll be coming on the clouds, and I will divide everybody into two groups. You'll have the goats on the left and the sheep on the right. And you know the story that the goats are the ones that he addresses second. The first one he addresses are the sheep. And he says, when I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. When I was naked, you clothed me. And he goes down the list. And then they say, Lord, when did we ever see you hungry or naked or homeless or thirsty? When did we see these things? And he said, I tell you, when you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And then he tells them, time to go to heaven. And then when he turns to the goats, it's the opposite. When I was hungry, you didn't give me any food. When I was thirsty, you didn't give me anything to drink. When I was naked, you didn't give me any clothing, etc. Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or naked or homeless? And he says, I tell you, because you didn't do it to the least of these, you didn't do it to me. And they go to hell. They go to the place of punishment, of fire, Jesus says, that was prepared for the devil and for his angels. So we know the story, and we know that when the time comes, we will all be judged. This is called the general judgment. You have your particular judgment, as we all will, right after you die. That's what I call the exit interview, when you'll give an account of your life. And you'll know then, you'll know with whether you'll spend all eternity in separation from God in hell, or you will spend all eternity in the company of God and his angels and saints in heaven. That's where you find out for sure. And for those who say, well, I already know I'm saved. I already know that. Well, don't forget, Jesus talked about people who had the very same view and will be shocked when the time comes. Remember, he said that, you know, it's not the one who says to me, Lord, Lord, who enters the kingdom, but it's the one who does the will of my Father. And he says, there will be some who on that day will say, Lord, didn't we cast out demons in your names? And didn't we do mighty deeds in your name? And he'll say, away from me, you evildoers. I never knew you. So there will be people when they get to their exit interview who maybe in this life are super confident that they're saved. They're on their way to heaven. Nothing can change that. And they will be surprised when they find out that that is not actually what's happening. So what's my point? I mean, how does this tie in with the Wall Street Journal story about the Zoom calls and meeting people for the first time? Well, I think the connection is this. On that last day, when we are in the general judgment and all of us will be there, you'll be there, I'll be there. Look for me. I'll look for you. It's all going to be public. And you know, Jesus also said that what is done in secret, what is done in the dark, what you do when you think nobody's watching, he says those things are going to be brought out into the light. They're going to be shouted from the rooftops. And that applies not just to sin. I think that maybe is the first direction that we go in when we see those words of our Lord. We think about, oh, what about secret sins? What about the sins that, you know, we thought nobody would ever know about? That's definitely part of that, but also the secret virtue, the secret goodness, the secret uprightness that may not have been apparent, but things that were done in secrecy, so to speak, things that God sees, of course, those too are going to be made public. So just as it's true that in the Wall Street Journal, documenting people who haven't seen each other, like really seen each other three-dimensionally, up close and personal, they've only talked on the phone or they've only been on a Zoom call, they only have a kind of two-dimensional, at best, understanding of who the other person is. And then when they meet face-to-face, they realize, oh my gosh, there's so much more. I didn't know this. The same is going to be true when we get to that general judgment and beyond. There will be people who outwardly look like scoundrels. The person that you would judge to say that, look at her, she's no good, or she's this, or she's that, or the you know, these judgments that we make often foolishly and rashly. And I guarantee you, there are going to be people who will be saints in heaven, and you'll be surprised to see them there. And they may be surprised to see you there. Conversely, there will be people who outwardly at least presented themselves as paragons of virtue, and maybe they founded religious orders, or maybe they did all kinds of wonderful things, only to find out that they were frauds. And that what you thought you knew about that person turns out not to be true. It wasn't the whole story. It wasn't the rest of the story, as the saying goes. So all will be revealed, and everything that is true will be known. Now, that leads to another question, and I don't have the, you know, the final answer on this issue, but I can certainly tell you what I hope is the answer, and that is to the question, will the people who are going to heaven be made to be ashamed when their sins are told publicly? Will their sins be told publicly? Will you, if you go to heaven, please God, you will. The question is, will your sins of your past life be disclosed publicly for all to see? And I don't know the exact answer to that question. It's possible. I think, based upon what I've read among church fathers and other sources, I think that the plausible answer is that for those who are friends of God, for those who are going to go to heaven, they don't suffer that indignity because they're not being punished, that their sins, the truth of the sinfulness of their lives, whatever that may be, will not be held up publicly for people to see. I'm really kind of hoping that that's the way it's going to go. Now, that those who are going to hell, they're, of course, going to experience that public ignominy. They're going to be shown for who they really are. And, you know, let's do everything possible by God's grace not to be in that group. But I thought it was interesting. And it's a way to consider something as simple as, you know, a Zoom meeting and people you think you know, and you may not really know them at all. I'm sure you've had that experience where, you know, I thought I knew you. I thought we were friends. I never thought you would do something like this. I mean, that's a fairly common occurrence in life, isn't it? So think about that. And for my money, honestly, this is just a reminder that it pays to be good. It pays to try to be virtuous. Because if nothing else, you're going to have that much less dirty laundry that you're going to have to see out there for everybody to see. The less you commit sin and the more you cultivate virtue, the less you have to worry about. No matter what happens, no matter what may transpire, you'll be in a much better position. This is something, transitioning here, that was written by St. Louis. And a friend of mine, and this is King Louis of France, I believe it's King Louis IX, if I'm not mistaken. A friend of mine sent this to me, and it's quite beautiful, and I'd like to share it with you because it's a father's advice to his son about what you can do and how you can live your life. I think it speaks for itself, but let me just share this with you. A just king rules the earth. My dearest son, my first instruction is that you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your strength. Without this, there is no salvation. Keep yourself, my son, from everything that you know displeases God, that is to say, from every mortal sin. You should permit yourself to be tormented by every kind of martyrdom before you would allow yourself to commit a mortal sin. If the Lord has permitted you to have some trial, bear it willingly and with gratitude, considering that it has happened for your good and that perhaps you well deserved it. If the Lord bestows upon you any kind of prosperity, thank Him humbly and see that you become no worse for it, either through vain pride or anything else, because you ought not to oppose God or offend Him in the matters of His gifts. Listen to the divine office with pleasure and devotion. As long as you are in the church, be careful not to let your eyes wander and not to speak empty words, but pray to the Lord devoutly, either aloud or with the interior prayer of the heart. Be kind-hearted to the poor, the unfortunate, and the afflicted. Give them as much help and as much consolation as you can. Thank God for all the benefits He has bestowed upon you, that you may be worthy to receive greater. Be just to your subjects, swaying neither to the right nor left, but holding the line of justice. Always side with the poor rather than that of the rich, until you are certain of the truth. See that all your subjects live in justice and peace, but especially those who have ecclesiastical rank and who belong to religious orders. Be devout and obedient to our Mother, the Church of Rome, and the Supreme Pontiff as your spiritual father. Work to remove all sin from your land, particularly blasphemies and heresies. In conclusion, dearest son, I give you every blessing that a loving father can give a son. May the three persons of the Holy Trinity and all the saints protect you from every evil, and may the Lord give you the grace to do His will, so that He may be served and honored through you, that in the next life we may together come to see Him, love Him, and praise Him unceasingly. Amen. Oh my, what a beautiful way of a father handing on the truth of the faith and love of God to his son. That's probably a great note to take a quick break on. When we come back, I will be diving again back into your emails. We'll be covering a lot of ground. You don't want to miss this. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. I'll be right back.
You have one new message.
Hi, Patrick. This is former President Bill Clinton. Look, I just want to tell you, I love your show. I bet you get a lot of emails. You know, come to think of it, if you need a private email server, I know someone that can get you one.
You've got mail.
The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Okay, we're back. The hour does go by quickly. Thanks again for listening. Emails. If you want to send me an email, just go to the show page. Go to RelevantRadio.com/Patrick. You'll see where you can send me a message. They do come directly to me. I enjoy reading them, and I do read all of them, so thank you for that. This comes in from Lisa, who says, on your program, you've mentioned options for healthcare, specifically the insurance option you use. I'm searching for another insurance. The insurance my employer used to carry was good, but now it's almost unaffordable to part-time employees. They don't want to hire full-time employees due to the benefit costs. So what are my options? Okay, well, you have a number of options, of course. You asked about what I'm using. Nancy and I, we use Solidarity Health Share, and solidarityhealthshare.org is their website if you want to look them up. And they don't know that I'm going to tell you about this. They are friends of the network, though, so you'll hear messages about Solidarity when you listen to Relevant Radio. But just for my part, since you asked me, the background of the story is that for many years, I carried my own health insurance. And like most other people experienced, it got more and more and more expensive to the point where it was about $1,800, $1,850 a month is what we were paying with a very high deductible. I think the family deductible was about $10,000. So every month we're forking out $1,850 and we could never hit that deductible because thankfully we're healthy people. And so we didn't go to the doctor very much. So we didn't have, you know, we could never get to that deductible. So it was like just pouring money down a drain every month. That's what it felt like. And So it just got intolerable when we received notice from the insurance company that the premiums were going to go well over $2,000 a month. And I thought, this is enough. I can't justify this. So I really started to search and to study and to ask around. And eventually we found Solidarity HealthShare, which is a Catholic-owned organization. And I saw my premium reduced drastically. So from, say, $2,000+ a month, it got, 75% of that was chopped down. And that was, years ago. So the premiums, they do rise a little bit here and there over time. But it was a dramatic reduction in what we were spending per month. And what I really appreciated was the fact that this Catholic organization, this fledgling Catholic organization that's doing something really good by offering, it's not technically insurance, it's actually more, it's member funding. It's, if you go to their website, it'll explain it to you. It's almost like a distinction without a difference. But in any case, they don't fund abortions, they don't fund contraception, they don't fund any of those things. And so from a moral standpoint, that made a lot of sense to me. So that's the direction that we went in. But there are other organizations out there. And if I were you, I would do what we did, and that's do some searching around. But if you're interested in this friend of the network, who definitely is a group that I can certainly vouch for personally, I would suggest take a look at Solidarity HealthShare. Now we'll go to an email from Maureen, who says, Patrick, my son is at a small liberal arts college in the Northeast and has been frequently challenged about his faith. He lately has been asked to defend the church's position that no women can become priests. Is there some specific reference I can give him? The woman challenging him is convinced that he cannot support it, other than saying that's how it's always been, since Christ himself instituted the priesthood. Is there some material you can give me that I can forward to him? He has reached out for my help. Many thanks, Maureen. Okay, Maureen, yes. I would suggest that you begin by sending him a link to the document by Pope John Paul II. It's called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. So that's the Latin phrase, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, that we would translate into English as on priestly ordination. And it's not a lengthy document. It was written back in, what was it? I think it was maybe 88, 89, something like that. And in this message, he explains a few things. Number one, he explains why the church does not admit women to the sacrament of holy orders. Why is this only for men? And he also talks about how the church has no authority to change this teaching. So in other words, it's not something that the church can change. In a way similar to the church has no power to say, well, all right, we're going to add another person to the Godhead. So heretofore it was the Trinity, one God and three persons. We're going to change that now and add Mary or some, we're going to do something else. The church can't do that. The church doesn't have the power to do that. Divine revelation being what it is true as God revealed it. And so the church accepts it and believes it, but doesn't have the power to change it. I remember one time I had a very odd conversation with a Catholic who asked me an odd question that suggested to me he didn't really understand the issue of the sacraments, because he said, well, the sacrament of, say, anointing of the sick or one of the other sacraments, he says, I wonder if someday the church will reconfigure it. And I said, reconfigure it? What do you mean? That's like science fiction language. That's like technology language. What do you mean reconfigure the sacrament? He said, just change it so that it can be used in a different way or by different people. And I said, well, don't forget that the sacraments come to us from God. Jesus himself established the sacraments. They're outward signs that give grace, established by Jesus. And so as he established them, the church has the authority to oversee how they're administered and, some of the precise details, like what is the ritual all about, what happens. The church has the authority to change those things. But the essence of the sacrament itself, the church has no authority to change, because these don't come from the church, they come from Jesus. And I don't know if what I said made any sense to him, but I've never forgotten that odd comment that he made. So in light of this discussion, keep in mind that this sacrament, the sacrament of holy orders, was established by Jesus and in a particular way. So Pope John Paul II points out that Jesus, first of all, he could have, in theory at least, chosen an even higher person than the apostles to be the first priest, and that would be the Blessed Virgin Mary. Interesting that alone among all the other religions, the Catholic Church is the one that proclaims that the single greatest human person who ever lived is the Blessed Virgin Mary. Keep in mind that Jesus is not a human person. He's a divine person with a human nature. But in Mary's case, she's a human person. So she stands at the apex of all of humanity when it comes to being the greatest, the most holy of all of human beings. I forget who said this. It might have been Chesterton, but our nature's solitary boast, you know, the one person that we can point to and say, look at her. And Jesus did not choose her for the priesthood. He chose these men, one of whom turned out to betray him. And Jesus knew that. But you can see that it wasn't a beauty contest. He didn't pick only the best and the brightest. He had a lot of problems with St. Peter, who was a brash, impulsive man. And Jesus chose him, as well as the other 11 apostles, to be the first priests. And he ordained them as priests at the Mass, at the Last Supper, the first Mass that was celebrated. And he did not choose women. So that's one of the things that Pope John Paul II points out. He says, because, first of all, this is not something that the Church made. The Church didn't make this, and the Church doesn't have the authority to remake it. We have to look at the person who did make it, and that's Jesus. And what did he do? He ordained men. Okay, that's one of the topics he discusses. Then he gets into and I don't know if this is necessarily chronologically how he does this, but by memory. He also speaks about some of the arguments that people try to make. They attempt to deflect this information by saying, yeah, well, that was just because Jesus was a product of his time. And he did things in this culture and community a certain way because it was patriarchal and they wouldn't have accepted it if he had done it a different way. So he was, you know, he's kind of bound by the customs. And Pope John Paul II, he just, you know, flicks that off like a fly or a mosquito. And he says, of course he didn't do that. Jesus broke all kinds of customs and mores. You know, he picked grain to eat on the Sabbath. And that was considered work. It was considered forbidden work on the Sabbath by the Pharisees and others. And Jesus said, hey, we're hungry. And for that matter, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So he turned that dictate on its head, and he did things his way because, of course, he, being God, is the Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus, he did all kinds of things. He had meals and get-togethers with prostitutes and tax collectors and people that the high and mighty thought were untouchable. You know, you should stay away from them. You shouldn't be near them. Jesus did all these things and many other things, and Pope John Paul II points this out. So far from Jesus being constrained by the cultural and moral dictates of his culture, Jesus was frequently, he was frequently bending those rules, breaking those rules, because he could, because he's God. So the reasoning goes, if indeed he wanted women to be ordained into the priesthood, he would have done so. There would have been nothing stopping him, because he's God. So these and a few other issues that Pope John Paul II gets into point out that the reason that the Church reserves the sacrament of holy orders to men alone is, in part, yes, because that's what Jesus established, and yes, because the Church has recognized all along that this is what he intended, but also for a few other reasons. And this is where maybe your son can have a little more interesting conversation with them. The relationship between Christ and his Church is one of bridegroom and bride. And St. Paul elaborates on this theme a number of times in his epistles. Jesus is the bridegroom. He's the husband. The bride, feminine, is the Church. Now, obviously, the Church is comprised of male and female. That's true. But as an entity, as an organism unto itself, comprised of human members, the Church is feminine insofar as it is the bride of Christ. The Church receives what Christ the bridegroom gives. The Church does not give Christ anything. The Church does not proactively do something that Christ receives. Now, I'm not talking about our love. I'm not talking about our worship. I'm not talking about those things. But as an ontological matter of fact, the Church is feminine, especially insofar as she receives into herself what Christ the bridegroom gives her, the sacraments, revelation, etc. Now, as you're probably guessing, there is a nuptial dimension to this. And the nuptial dimension to this is that of husband and wife, bridegroom and bride. And so part of the deeper theology that underlies this is the recognition that the priest acts in persona Christi, the phrase in Latin that means in the person of Christ. He's not Christ, but he's acting as an instrument, you might say, of Christ, or even in a certain sense, a kind of icon of Christ. And when he stands at the altar and he is saying, "This is my body, which is given for you." Now, keep in mind, there's nothing erotic. Please do not have any erotic associations with this. We're not talking about eroticism. But there is a nuptial marriage-based dimension to this language. And so the priest is speaking the words of marital love. This is Jesus speaking, and the priest is standing in persona Christi, in the person of Christ. And he's speaking these words of marital love to his bride. So when Jesus is saying to the bride, "This is my body, which is given for you," with all the connotations that go along with that, minus the erotic ones, does this have some connection, you might ask, to the marital act between the husband and the wife? In a sense, it does, but again, minus any carnal or sexual connotations. Those are not present here. But the deeper meaning, even behind the sexual relationship between the husband and the wife, that is what is going on here, that Jesus is giving himself entirely to his bride, the church, and the church gives herself entirely to the bridegroom. Well, one of the problems, without being able to go terribly far into this issue, one of the problems is if you have a woman standing at the altar, you can see immediately the distortion of the roles and the way in which suddenly now everything is confused, because now you have a woman speaking in the voice of the bridegroom, speaking the words of marital love to the other woman, aka the church. And so that would be a huge distortion. It would be a dramatic departure from the meaning of what is being said there at the altar, among other ways. And the church simply points out, as Pope John Paul II did, that the essence of the Sacrament of Holy Orders, it requires the ability to act in persona Christi, and that is rooted in masculinity. That is rooted in the man who, as Jesus himself was revealed to us as a man, it says something. There's some meaning behind it. It's not just a haphazard thing. Some people say, well, Jesus could have come as a woman, or Jesus could have come as an angel. No. Jesus revealed himself to us. The second person of the Trinity revealed himself to us in the form of a man, not because God is a man. God is not a man. God does not have a body. God is not male or female. God transcends those things. But the role of fatherhood to generate, to provide, if we're talking about procreation, notice here again that the woman is receptive. She receives into herself, and the man, he's projecting and he is giving of himself. It's external to him. It's going out from him. And this is what leads to life, the woman receiving, etc. So these are human ways of looking at a deeper reality in God. And this is why he, in the case of Jesus, why he revealed himself to us in a masculine form. So one final little point here I can mention would be, and there's much more to say, but I'll have to leave it at this. When you consider the fact that by nature, women can have children, they can conceive babies in their wombs, and they can bring them to term after 9 months of gestation, and they can give birth to a baby. Why can they do that? Because they are equipped for it. They have the ability. Men don't have birth canals. You can't physically push a baby out of your body. Even if you could physically push a baby out of your body, you don't have the ability, because you don't have what's necessary as a man to conceive a child and to gestate a child and to give birth to a child and to nurse a child. All those things men are incapable of doing by nature. Now, does this mean that women are better than men? No. It just means that we're different. We're complementary, and we have different things that we are apt to be able to do that is true for men but not women, and true for women but not men. So we can understand it in a natural context in the case of motherhood, and women just have an ability to do something by nature that men don't have the ability to do. And what the church is saying is that in the spiritual realm, something similar is at play. Now, I'll have to leave it at that because we do have a break coming up. In the meantime, though, we'll get a link posted to that document from Pope John Paul II, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. And while you're at it, you should read that, too. That would be a very helpful thing. You can start there. And I appreciate you sending me the email. Thank you very much. Quick time out, and we'll come back with more right after this.
G'day. This is Tom Brokaw, NBC Nightly News. The internet has collapsed. National security officials are now blaming it on the high volume of emails being sent to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. We'll have more tonight on the NBC Nightly News.
You've got mail.
Mail time. It's mail time? Already? Really? Okay, we'll be right there, mailbox.
Got a box full of letters.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Okay, we're back, and I'm sharing with you today just a whole pile of emails that I have not had a chance to get to. There are plenty more besides these, but we're going to try to knock out as many as we can. So I won't be doing phone calls this hour, but let's take it away. Let's have another one. This is from Connie, who says, Hi, Patrick. I love your show. My mom has some holy water that she says is now rancid and smells, and she wants to know how to get rid of it. I told her I would take it and use it, but she said no. Anyways, can she just pour it around the house or on the outside for protection from the evil one? Connie. Good question, Connie. Well, yes, these kinds of things happen, and holy water will not last forever. And so you could simply, and if it smells bad, if it's rancid, I would just pour it into the sink, pour it into a flower pot, pour it onto the ground outside. There's nothing wrong with doing that. And then, of course, rinse out that container and get some more holy water from the church. So that's what I would do with holy water that's reached that stage. Prior to holy water becoming contaminated or stale or, you know, nasty in some way, the thing to do with it is to bless yourself with it. There are many Catholic families who will have a little holy water font, maybe just inside the front door or whatever door you typically come into the house. And whether coming or going, I've seen many Catholics, and we've done this in our house too, you just, you know, make the sign of the cross like you would when you're entering into a church. It's a reminder of your baptism and how Jesus takes us down through the waters of baptism. And just as God saved the Israelites at the time of Moses and then destroyed the Egyptian army that was pursuing them and just drowning all of them in the waters after the Israelites had passed through and they were protected from the water, well, in the same kind of way, when Jesus leads us down through the waters of his death, burial, and resurrection, the sins, which are analogous to the Egyptian chariots, the pursuers, the ones who wanted to keep the Israelites in slavery and bondage, they're all destroyed. So when you bless yourself with holy water, it's a way of remembering what Jesus did for you in and through the sacrament of baptism. He destroyed the power of the evil one over you. He rescued you from the condition of original sin. And in so doing, when you're baptized, your soul is completely animated now. Prior to that, it was inert. It was spiritually inert, like a car. Imagine a brand new car parked in your driveway, and it's just sitting there. It can't do what cars are made to do, but it looks pretty. It's just sitting there, but it's inert because it's not turned on. So when you get in the car and you turn the key on, turn the ignition on, and you then can go out on the open road, then the car is able to do what cars are made to do, made to travel. But you can't do it unless you turn the car on. And that's, of course, analogous to the sacrament of baptism. That's the ignition, you might say, in which God's grace floods the soul. The soul is regenerated. That means reborn. The condition of original sin is eradicated. All the effects of sin, everything in the case of an adult, certainly, all those past sins of the life would be wiped away and all the effects of those sins. Now, in the case of an infant, there are no sins, but that soul is now ready to roll and also apt to receive the other sacraments. Without baptism, you're not able to receive the other sacraments. So for that reason, when you bless yourself with holy water, you are recalling that, you're blessing yourself, you're reminding yourself that God loves you, you're asking God to bless you and protect you, for example, if you're going on a trip, that kind of thing. So prior to holy water going bad, in which case you can pour it out, I would use it liberally. Bless your home with it. Bless your children with it. Bless yourself with it. It's not magic. It doesn't confer magical protection or anything, but it's symbolic, and it is a powerful symbol indeed as a sacramental of God's love for you and his care for you. It's also something that the devils hate and fear. And this is something told to us by many great saints and certainly many exorcists, that the devil hates holy water. And that's all. I'd like to get a super soaker full of holy water just to keep the devil at bay, huh? That's not a bad way to handle it. Let's see. This comes in from Stephen, who says, I'm a regular listener to your show, and I trust your opinion. Well, thank you, Stephen. He says, what is your take on Blaise Pascal? I'm reading a book on Pascal's pensées, and that's a French word that means thoughts, but then discovered that he might have been a Jansenist. I want, of course, to steer clear of heresy. Peter Kraft says he was not a Jansenist. Should I be cautious of reading Pascal? No, not. I wouldn't be at all conscious or what's the word that he uses there? Cautious. I would not be cautious about that. Blaise Pascal, he's not a canonized saint, but he's a significant Catholic thinker. He was a philosopher and a mathematician, a very intense and well-studied guy, very erudite guy. And he, in his pensées, what he's doing there is he's offering commentary on thoughts on a variety of aspects of faith in God. So that is considered in later Catholic literature, one of the towering works of literature produced by a Catholic, in this case, a layman. And I would highly recommend it. I remember when I first read it, I thought, this is really good. And some people can do very wonderful things and write a lot of important work and at the same time have struggles in their own lives or have struggles in their faith life. So, yes, I know that people have accused him of Jansenism. I'm with Peter Kraft on this one. I don't believe he was based upon what I've seen. And Peter Kraft is a world-class philosopher. He's taught for many years at Boston College in the philosophy department. And I call him this generation C.S. Lewis. So he knows far more about Blaise Pascal than I do. And I know a fair amount, but he knows far more than I do. And so I can, without any hesitation, I can say, trust Peter Kraft's opinion on this issue. Because if anyone would know, he would know. And I hope you find that helpful. Thank you, Stephen. This one comes in from Barbara. Barbara says, I've studied the Bible and theology in college, and was taught that when God clothed Adam and Eve in Genesis, the Hebrew word translated to the English as garment means a covering that includes elbows and knees, which tells us God's standard of modesty is quite different from society's. Also, some callers on your show are concerned about the church rejecting homosexuals. My understanding from reading the Catechism is that while the church does not condone homosexual acts and requires celibacy, it does not only accept homosexuals, but also has compassion for them and holds them in prayer. What the church members say or think about homosexuals, that indicates that they aren't welcome, is coming from ignorance. Both heterosexuals and homosexuals are required to practice celibacy when they are not married, and marriage is for a man and a woman alone. Thanks for reading. I enjoy the show. Well, thank you very much, Barbara. Two big questions there. Let's start with the first one. So I am not a Hebrew scholar, far from it, so I can't pronounce in any authoritative way on the issue of what was said in Genesis chapter 3 with regard to the garment. That would be the kind of thing that if you wanted to consult a concordance, you would be able to do that, and you'd be able to see what some of the possible interpretations of that are. So let's take a look quickly at what we see. So in Genesis 3, verse 1, we see where the serpent tempts Adam and Eve. In verse 7, it says the eyes of both were opened and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Now, that's not the same garment that you're referring to. This is their makeshift effort to try to hide themselves because they recognize, you know, suddenly now they were no longer innocent as they once had been. Then we go and we see a little further on that when God asks Adam, he says, where are you? Verse 9. And then Adam says, I heard the sound of thee in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. He said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? And of course, God knows everything. So he wasn't asking because he didn't know. He was asking because it was time for Adam to fess up to what he had done. But he doesn't even really fess up to it. He blames his wife. So in verse 12, the woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree and I ate it. And then the Lord God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? The woman said, the serpent beguiled me and I ate it. So there's a lot of blame game going on here. So then God pronounces the maledictions, and he talks about what will happen to the serpent and to the man and the woman, and because they have eaten, all the things that will accrue to them in a negative sense, and how they were then cast out of the Garden of Evil, or Garden of Eden. So in verse 21 is where we see the word that you're referring to. And the Lord God made for Adam and for his wife garments of skin and clothed them. Now, what's interesting about this is that here we see death entering in because those garments of skin came from animals. And the animal obviously had to die in order to furnish this material for Adam and Eve to have clothing. So right there at the very beginning, you see that death is involved, not only the death of their innocence, but also the death of these animals. And this was part of the penalty of sin. So that gets us now to the question, well, what is this word? What was this word that was used there? Kethoneth is the way you would pronounce it. Now, again, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I can't pronounce with any authority, but in considering Strong's exhaustive concordance, this is the information that's given. So kethoneth, and it could be translated into English as a tunic or an undergarment or a long shirt-like garment, typically of linen. So if you consider these possible translations and also how it appears in other parts of the Bible, when the same word is there, what is it describing? It's describing something that covers much of your body. And so for that reason, if you want to read into that a kind of statement on God's part about what kind of clothing men and women should wear, I mean, you could do that. And I don't think it would be necessarily wrong to see in that a connotation that God was showing them that they should cover up more of their body rather than less of their body. But beyond that, the church doesn't have any specific teaching. It's just an interesting lexical feature. It's something that we can consider and we can maybe draw some conclusions with regard to. But it would be more likely to describe it as a kind of robe, a kind of long shirt, a kind of a tunic that might come down to your knees kind of thing. One interesting side note is that the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they have, as part of their panoply of religious duties, they have what are called by, you know, outsiders, they call it magic underwear. Mormons would refer to it as the sacred undergarments or the temple garments that would go under the temple garments that they would wear out, you know, outside the when they would go to the temple. But these undergarments are intended to be worn all the time, unless you're taking a shower, of course. And if you see these, and you can see them by just Googling Mormon undergarments, you'll see that they come down to the knee. So they come down right to the knee. They come down to the middle of your arm, right where the elbow is. And so they have patterned these undergarments along the lines of what we see in Genesis chapter 3 with regard to the garment that God made for Adam and Eve. Very interesting. It doesn't mean that that's, you know, true. It just means that that's where I believe that they got that. So this email comes in from Patrick, who says, I'm looking to you for your knowledge or resources about the covenant of marriage. What are resources that explain the Catholic teaching about gay marriage? What does the church teach? Or what is your belief or advice about Catholics attending a gay marriage? Well, I'll start there. I don't recommend that at all, because you wouldn't want to go and feign celebrating something that's objectively wrong. And as Jesus himself said in Matthew chapter 19, that marriage is between a man and a woman. It's not between two men. It's not between two women. And he says, this is the pattern that God established, the man and the woman together. That's marriage. So anything other than that is going to be a breach of what God ordained. And so you couldn't celebrate that. I mean, you could go and pretend, I guess, but what would be the point of that? I think it would be giving scandal. But more importantly, what does the church say on this issue? Now, it's a very big topic, and we only have about a minute to go before I have to wrap things up. So let me refer you to the best resource I can give you in short order, and that would be a mock debate that I did with Father Mike Schmitz a few years ago at Franciscan University's Defending the Faith Conference. and it's 2 hours long. It's a moderated debate. And I took the position, although I don't hold this position, I did my very best. I studied. I watched the videos defending same-sex marriage. I read the books and articles, and I did my very best in the time that I had to accurately and as strongly as possible make the case for same-sex marriage. Father Mike Schmitz, he took the church's position to explain why, no, the only kind of marriage there is a marriage between a man and a woman. So because I'm out of time, Patrick, I'll refer you to that video. It's available on YouTube. Last I checked, I think it had been watched like 250,000 times. And so you want to look up Patrick Madrid, Father Mike Schmitz, same-sex marriage debate. And it's right there. It's about 2 hours long. And Father Mike Schmitz does such a great job that really anything I could tell you on the air, you're going to hear on that debate. And I hope you find that helpful. Well, that's it for me for today. I look forward to being with you again soon. And between now and then, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.